You're listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG online at kpcg.fm. Live link also at thetrumpet.com. Thanks for joining us today on Trumpet Radio Live Weekend Edition. Dwight Falk with you here and Abraham Blondeau. I almost couldn't say my name there. That's a bad start. You can't even get your own name out.
It is Friday.
It is Friday. Yeah, it's an excuse for that. We have a lot to talk about today, some headlines to get to. Also talk about the Key of David program and the Trumpet Daily Radio Show coming to you from Jerusalem today, actually. So we'll talk about that. Also, some things that have happened on this day in history, and then an interesting feature piece in the middle there about PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome. They're learning more about that. People go off to battle and come back home, and a lot of times they have some real problems, mental difficulties that can occur, and there's more research about that. So interesting write-up from the New York Times Magazine. We're going to talk about that as well. I had an interesting beginning to my day today. I was telling Abraham about this earlier, and I told him the story, and then he actually had a really good joke about it. He said it was the modern ending to the tortoise and the hare. And what happened was, and that'll make sense in a second, but what happened was I have a cat, and the cat likes to hunt, which we appreciate, keeps the rodents out of the garden. But he likes to bring whatever he caught and put it by the door, so you know what he's been doing overnight. He's been earning his keep. Well, this morning we found part of a rabbit that he had taken care of and left part of it for us there. But there was a small turtle that was eating the rabbit, which I thought was really surprising to me. But I looked it up, and I guess apparently they do eat protein. So typically not something that big, but if it's already dead, I suppose. So this little turtle was really working at this this rabbit, and you just don't expect to wake up and see that.
Yes. Yeah, it definitely not.
And so anyway, I was telling Abraham about it, and he's like, yeah, that's how the story of the tortoise and the hare ends. And I thought, yeah, that's right. The turtle was slow, but in the end, he ate him.
Yeah. That's the moral of the story.
The moral of the story playing out in real life in my backyard. So, yeah, pretty interesting. And it was funny how it happened, too, because my wife saw it first, and she said, hey, take a look out the back window. And I thought, okay, so look out there. And I did not expect to see that, but interesting.
Yeah, I saw about a month ago, I think I saw a turtle laying eggs in our backyard. But it was a pretty big turtle. I have no idea how it got into our yard because it must have slipped under the fence or something. But it took about 20 minutes to leave the yard. At no point did I consider...
omelet?
Yes, or like thinking or protecting the my cat from the turtle or anything like that. But yeah, it was just an odd thing to see.
Yeah, lots of turtles around here in this Oklahoma area, so along with some other things as well. Well, interesting start to the day also with California on Friday here. They had a 5.2 magnitude earthquake. Rattled Southern California. They felt it in Los Angeles and San Diego. This report is from ABC. They say an earthquake with a preliminary magnitude of 5.2 shook Southern California early Friday morning. The quake was centered about 14 miles northwest of Borrego Springs and about 90 miles east of San Diego and hit just after 1 a.m. Residents reported feeling shaking from the earthquake in San Diego, West Los Angeles, Riverside, and Woodland Hills. There were no immediate reports of injuries or property damage. But at this point, they say they're just monitoring the activity, which, of course, is normal. Officials said the earthquake set off a lot of alarms at businesses, and the earthquake occurred along the San Jacinto Fault, historically the most active fault in Southern California, according to the seismologist Lucy Jones. So anytime there's an earthquake in California, it piques people's interest because they've had some big ones over the years. This one, pretty good size, 5.2.
Yeah, I think every year an article comes out from some scientist saying California is getting ready for the next big one because there hasn't been one since that big one hit San Francisco, a bigger quake. But, I mean, 5.2 is still big. So it'll be interesting to see what happens from this. And it doesn't sound like there's too much damage, thankfully. But yeah, it's we'll see if they get a little more frequent. I think earthquakes have even toned down here in Oklahoma, from at least from what I felt. But hopefully they don't travel over there where it could be a little more dangerous.
Yeah, we've had a few here that have been up in this, close to this, up close to a 5, I think. And I haven't felt them here in a while myself, but I do know there have been a few. You see the news reports, and then there was a write-up even the other day about the earthquakes. So interesting, and of course they are prepared somewhat for them out there. But if it's bad enough, you can't be that prepared, because
right.
Serious quakes do serious damage. So anyway, thankfully nothing too severe there, but I probably woke a few people up and a little early there in the morning, about 1 a.m., this other headline here, this is a hockey-related headline. NHL legend Gordie Howe died at 88 years of age. One of the greatest hockey players of all time, Gordie Howe, he was 88. And he was a legend in Detroit. He won 4 Stanley Cup championships in his 25 years as a player. For the Red Wings, it's a long time to play, especially a physical sport like hockey. A physical sport. Well, aren't they all physical sports? You know what I mean. One that's a little rougher.
Yeah.
I'll explain that one. He took the ice for the first time in 1946 and would be named an NHL All-Star 23 times in his illustrious career. 2 years, apparently, he couldn't make the All-Stars, but 23 out of 25 is pretty good. After his career ended in Detroit, he landed in the World Hockey Association with the Houston Aeros. A cause of death was not immediately known, but of course he was 88 and he'd had some health problems. So just old age, it looks like. That's a good long life, 88 years, and of course a hockey legend.
Yeah, he's one of the most famous ones, well known, especially since he did live a long time. And he had good enough health where he could still appear in public, and especially at Joe Louis Arena there in Detroit. And he's famous for the Gordie Howe hat trick, which I believe is a goal, a fight, and assist, I think. You need 3 of those to get the Gordie Howe hat trick.
Right.
But he's a tougher player, but he did hold the league scoring title, I believe, until Wayne Gretzky passed them. And he also did a lot for the community, if you read about what he's done. Him and a lot of the older players there have actually done a lot for hockey and just for people in general there. It's sad to see him go, but he did live a long life. He did a lot too, saw a lot of things. I think he was the oldest hockey player as well. He played when he was 50.
Yeah.
And for the Hartford Whalers.
Yeah, it's interesting that it seems like when kind of famous people die, there's a few of them. You know, Ali died recently, and then Gordie Howe. I think there's been even a couple of others in there somewhere. So interesting to see that occur. This next headline here is from Fox News. If you've ever been to an amusement park, you can appreciate this. Power outage at North Carolina amusement park strands visitors on 300-foot tower ride. It's a bad time for the power to go out. A power outage at Carowinds amusement park left guests stranded on multiple rides late on Thursday evening. The theme park, which straddles the border between North and South Carolina near Charlotte, experienced a loss of power about 7:50 p.m., the outage lasted for about 3 minutes, but the ride stopped, so you can get stuck on those. The Charlotte Observer reported that park staff were manually lowering the ride about an hour and 40 minutes after it got stuck. So these people are stuck up on this 300-foot tower, and they have to manually lower them. That could be frustrating and maybe a little frightening, I guess. According to one of the local stations out there, UNC Charlotte student Josh Bryant said that he was stranded on the ride with his girlfriend and her family when the power went down. He said, "We have been stuck on the Wind Seeker ride at Carowinds for over 2 hours now. We're finally slowly making our way down at what it feels like a couple inches every 4 to 5 minutes." He said the group was not happy with the way the park handled the emergency. So I don't think anybody would be happy being stuck up there. I don't know what else you do, though. I would rather come down like a few inches, you know, a minute, as opposed to all at once.
Right. Yeah.
So that's another way to look at it.
Yeah. I'm not sure if you can really fault the park. I don't think there's a lot they can do. I'd rather be safe than sorry as well, especially when you're dealing with these different things. And I've never been stranded on one, but I can imagine it would be not only frustrating, but there's always that thought in the back of your mind, like, well, what's actually holding us up if there's no power and all those different things? So glad they didn't get hurt or like nothing happened. But yeah, I can understand their frustration, but I'd just be grateful that got out of there in one piece.
I mean, look, I think the park could use this as sort of a something to drum up more business, because you could say, look, the rides here are so exciting, you never know when you're going to get stuck. It could happen at any time. People go for the thrill, right?
That's true.
And then the other thing you could say is, you know, are you tired of going to parks where you wait in line forever and the ride's over in a couple of seconds? Not here at Carowinds. This ride will last multiple hours. You could spin it a couple of ways.
That's true, yeah. Instead of waiting in line for 3 hours, you can be on the ride for 3 hours.
Yeah.
So I think that's a win situation.
Just us all in the way you look at it. I haven't been to this park, but I've been to Six Flags in Dallas and in Chicago. And they do have one ride up in Chicago. It's the giant drop where you go up very high. I don't know how high it is. Same sort of thing. You're sitting just on this little seat and then they just drop you. And it's a little bit frightening.
Yeah.
And again, you do think like, what's stopping us at the bottom now? You know, make sure everything's working here.
Yeah.
So I wonder what would happen if the power went out in the middle of like that fall or something. I don't want to think about that. I'm sure there's safeties built in or something, but
yeah, it probably has automatic brakes. I mean, it would probably still hurt. You're free falling and all of a sudden it would probably stop or something like that. I don't know how those rides are designed necessarily, but I was at Six Flags in Dallas, a year ago, and we were just approaching it and we were just looking at all the different rides. And there was one in particular really high up, and you're on this little seat with like a cable connecting you to the spinning top. And you're up there, I think, 100 feet at least, a couple hundred feet, and you're just in this little chair spinning around. And we all looked at each other and like, we're not going to do that one.
You know the thing that gets me at those parks? The only thing that really gets me is the teacups. I can ride the coasters and all that, and that doesn't really bother me.
Yeah.
But the teacups, because we were at, I think it was in Dallas, and the Six Flags. And it was one of those things where we had been on a few rides. It was kind of the middle of the day. And the lines are really long. And so you're kind of looking around like, well, what can I get on quick and just do a few rides? And it was that more of that kid section. And we're like, sure. Somebody had the idea. Let's go on the teacups. Okay.
Yeah.
Terrible decision. Terrible decision. The teacups were followed by about 30 minutes of me just sitting on the bench nearby going, you know what? Everyone go on. You come back and get me later. That just messed me up for the whole day. When you get older, you just can't be spun in circles.
Yeah.
At least I can't.
The only thing that gets me at the parks is usually the funnel cake.
I avoid that.
Yes. I end up spending a lot on it, or everyone eats it all before I even get a piece and I have to go buy another one. Or it's just once you eat it, your day's kind of done on the ride. So.
Yeah, it's a really weird combination. You know, rides that can make you a little queasy, food you probably shouldn't be eating.
Yeah.
If you go in the summer, it's really hot. It's
mascots that make you feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
All those different things.
That's true. That's true. Very interesting. If you're heading out to the amusement parks, I guess you have to watch out for the power outage possibility. Here's one more headline today. This is one, actually, Abraham, that you brought up earlier to my attention today, and I found it, thought it was really interesting when I read it. It's from CNN.com. Britain's Royal Navy warships are breaking down because the sea is too hot. It just seems like Britain's having problems with even when they're trying to do something militarily, things aren't working out. Same could be said for the U.S. probably, and Israel also. This one is surprising. Britain's £1 billion or $1.4 billion warships are losing power in the Persian Gulf because they cannot cope with the warm waters, MPs have been told. You spend that much money, you think you'd think about that. Six Type 45 destroyers have repeatedly experienced power outages because of the temperatures, leaving servicemen in complete darkness. That would be like a trivia question. What do theme parks and British warships have in common?
power
outages.
Loss. Yeah.
During the Defense Committee hearing on Tuesday, MPs questioned company executives about the warship failures. They said the equipment is having to operate in far more arduous conditions than were initially required, according to Rolls-Royce director Thomas Leahy. Managing director of BAE Systems Maritime, John Hudson, supported Lee's comments, adding, "The operating profile at the time was that there would not be repeated or continuous operations in the Gulf. Waters in the Persian Gulf can get as hot as 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 32 degrees Celsius." That's pretty warm.
Yeah.
But, you know, so fair enough. I mean, they might be right. Maybe the requirements they were given were different. But if you're going to spend that much money on these destroyers, you'd think you'd say, hey, what if we have to use them out in, you know, warmer waters? Let's just make sure we build them to those specs so that they can work. So this is interesting. I'm sure there's, you know, more to it than maybe meets the eye with just this initial report here. But still, that much money being spent for a ship that can't operate in a certain part of the world, this doesn't seem wise.
Yeah, I think I wouldn't fault the shipbuilders in this circumstance. I would fault the decades of poor policy decisions by the British government. I mean, these type of destroyers are actually the most advanced in the world of their type. But just the short-sightedness and even the idea that the Royal Navy wouldn't be deployed anywhere outside the English Channel and North Sea is ridiculous.
Why would you build such a capable ship, in a sense, to just like float it in your backyard?
Yeah, especially, I mean, they still have a naval base at Gibraltar at the mouth of the Mediterranean. You still have vital interests around the world. But I think this perfectly illustrates just how much leadership, initiative, and tradition Britain has surrendered. They have the proudest naval tradition in the world for centuries. They were the best navy. But now I think it shows how far they've fallen, where they can't even deploy their best ships to a key strategic area that would need them there. Persian Gulf. That's the two most likely places for a naval conflict in the world is the Persian Gulf and the South China Sea. If you can't operate in those, then what's the point? You can't engage in any meaningful operation until it's too late. As an article I wrote a couple of weeks ago on the Battle of Jutland brought out, World War One was really kind of the starting place of where they surrendered global sea power to the United States. Now we see the United States not willing to use their power. And when you can't rely on the United States to secure a certain place around the world, you have to do it yourself. And we're seeing just how dangerous the situation is. And just how much of a laughingstock the Royal Navy is, where they can't even deploy their best ships to an area and you're at the mercy of their enemies, really.
Yeah. Can you imagine being that crew that kind of figured out the problem? You know how it is. If you leave work or you're shopping or something, you get in your car and it won't start and you're like, oh, come on.
Yeah.
Now what? But here we're talking about, you know, £1 billion or $1.4 billion warship. And you're like, hey, what's going on?
Yeah. It just would be embarrassing. And I mean, Russia has sent new subs to the Mediterranean. Iran is sending out ships into the Persian Gulf more and more. You have all these... Russia just demonstrated from the Caspian Sea or the Black Sea their new cruise missile fired from a ship into Syria, I think hundreds of miles away. So you have all these other nations, and China's building a new aircraft carrier. So is Britain. But you have all these nations demonstrating their new power, their new technology, and the very best we have to offer doesn't even work.
You know what's interesting, too, just that dollar figure. They've spent that much on these ships, and that's just about as much as we've given to Iran.
Right.
It's interesting, yeah. Isn't it, how that much money is being spent and kind of in vain in a way, how maybe they can fix it or whatever. And then we give that same amount of money over to Iran so they can build up their military?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Well, the U.S., their budget from last year, 2015, on defense was $600 billion, and we can't even stop Iran from doing anything they want in Iraq and their own nuclear program.
Yeah. Don't want to.
Yes.
Yeah. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Live link at thetrumpet.com. You can also take us with you on the go. Use the TuneIn app, and you can take the programming here from KPCG with you. You can also follow us on Twitter if you'd like to. That's at kpcgfm. We send out some tweets, some links to programming, updates. We tweeted a picture of a pack of political trading cards the other day. I don't know if they're selling like hotcakes yet, not necessarily advocating that, but it was just funny. And you can send us questions, comments, or concerns to comments@kpcg.fm. We'll be happy to look at those for you as well. Thanks for sending those along. Dwight Falk, Abraham Blondeau with you here today. And this is an interesting write-up. It's from the New York Times Magazine, and it's a topic that very much impacts quite a few people that have gone over and fought in military conflicts. That is PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. The title is, "What if PTSD is more physical than psychological? A new study supports what a small group of military researchers has suspected for decades, that modern warfare destroys the brain." And so, of course, that's kind of a given, that it's not a, a healthy environment. But they're finding out that now the physical brain is getting damaged, as well as the emotional trauma that, that can occur from warfare.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating study, and I think it really illuminates the dangerous environment that modern combat is, and just the stress and the new challenges that soldiers face nowadays compared to maybe some in the past. And it does highlight a truth that people have thought ever since World War One, that shell shock, as they call it at the time, post-traumatic stress disorder or occupational stress injury, they all mean the same thing, that it is a physical injury. It actually physically alters the brain. And so all the, I think everyone is familiar with the certain symptoms, like cognitive disability, memory loss, strange behavior, all these things, is actually the result of physical injuries.
Yeah, one of the guys that they talk about in this article, you know, was a special operations forces member, and he fought in various battles. And I think he was early 30s now, so still pretty young, but obviously suffering from PTSD. And they had a picture of him, and on his back he's got tattoos, and it's the names of all the people that died that were in his group. In the conflict, and I think from what I recall, there was 18 that died in the conflict, but then there was another 5 that have killed themselves since they've come back, and so that's a whole nother issue that happens. There's the wartime death and that type of thing, but then there's this terrible just trend, I guess, or effect really of what happens when they come home, trying to deal with the scars of war. And as they're showing, this is that the brain is changing because of explosions, because of injury to the brain, and causing people problems. So obviously, there's some psychological harm. I mean, you can't see those things without having some psychological damage. But the physical brain's not working like it should in a lot of cases. And of course, this has been in the news a lot, even in terms of football and concussions, that when the brain gets jarred around, it starts to develop scar tissue in a sense.
Yeah.
And so they're finding that here as well.
Yeah, just to go over the science very briefly, it is really interesting with concussion-like problems, especially NFL players and other sports. They found that there's a protein that builds up. Kind of almost when they dissect the brain, look at it, it's almost like this brown.
It's kind of a sludge almost, yeah.
Yeah, like a fungus or something like growing on the brain. But it's just a buildup of proteins, a specific one that then blocks and warps the functions of the brain, and it causes those different reactions from the person. But it's slightly different with what they're finding now, and this article mainly focuses on the effects of explosions. So, and by explosion, they mean when there's a concussion wave, a shock wave, and then there's the actual gas and toxic fumes and everything. And what they're finding is the shockwave actually travels through the body. And when it hits different materials or organs of density, because the body's made of several different things, the shockwave changes. And when it changes wavelength in between those densities, that's where the most damage is caused. And in the brain, there's the gray tissue, which is where most of the functions are. And then there's the white tissue, which connects it. And those are different densities, and they're finding when those meet, they're finding the most scar tissue from these shock waves that just kind of rip apart that matter in the brain. And what they did to discover this is the U.S. Army from certain soldiers that died, they dissected the brains because there's no way of knowing otherwise, really, about how the effects are. And they found that it's like this brown dust, but they're actually tiny scars all along the brain. They've never seen it before. The top neurosurgeons in the world have never seen it.
It's different than the concussions suffered in a sport like a football or something.
Yes.
The brain looks different.
Yeah. Yeah, the there can be concussions as well. I mean, there's so much going on. And the article focuses mainly on the physical side effects. Obviously, there is some emotional effects as well because my dad has some friends in the Army who went to Bosnia, and they never had any they weren't exposed to explosions or anything like that, but they do have PTSD from just what they saw. They have flashbacks and everything like that. So there's different ways it does affect the brain chemistry even. The people from Rwanda, the UN observers, they could actually see their brain chemistry change as well because the stress, how your mind is compensating for all the extreme pressure it's under, it actually alters the brain chemistry, and you can't change it back.
And in that case, it wasn't due to explosions. It was just due to the stress. So
correct.
We're looking at, you know, when you're looking at PTSD, you're looking at multiple causes and multiple effects in the brain. The stress causing the chemistry to change, and then the actual physical damage that sometimes occurs, which again alters the way the brain functions.
Yeah, and this is, I think, something that is really interesting and important to look at because modern combat, there's a lot more of this. The nature of anti-terror activities, where there's IEDs, there's different explosions, that's the main use now, but also a lot of atrocities as well. They've increased, I think, since World War II, where, I mean, soldiers who saw the Holocaust never talked about it because they try to repress memories of what they saw in a lot of cases. And going over to Middle East, other regions, and there's been two genocides in the 1990s and soldiers trying to get over those. So it's a very volatile environment. And in a book called The Face of Battle by John Keegan, he has a really interesting quote from an American official report on combat exhaustion. And it kind of explains with how long a soldier can last and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just a brief paragraph here I'll read. And it says, there's no such thing as getting used to combat. Each moment of combat imposes a strain so great that men will break down in direct relation to the intensity and duration of their exposure. Psychiatric casualties are inevitable as gunshot and shrapnel wounds in warfare. Most men were ineffective after 180 or even 140 days. The general consensus was that a man reached his peak of effectiveness in the first 90 days of combat, and after that, his efficiency began to fall off, and he became steadily less valuable thereafter until he was completely useless. The number of men on duty after 200 to 240 days of combat was small and their value to their units negligible. So that was after studying World War II American soldiers.
Have you seen a study recently? Has that changed? Do you know?
Yes, it's decreased the effectiveness just because the intensity has increased.
The intensity has increased, and therefore they're only functioning at their best for a shorter period of time.
Yeah, so that's about 4 or 5 months, I believe. So you can see, just imagine only being able to do a job for 5 months, and then your brain is physically altered
for the rest of your life.
Yes,
yeah.
That's the extreme strain of combat nowadays. And the soldiers, unlike before, I mean, there were probably cases of this before, they just didn't know how, didn't understand it or didn't realize it. But now they bring it home with them, and their families experience it with them. The war never really ends for some people because it physically is embedded in their mind, literally. And it is something that is a constant plague. Veteran suicides is becoming an epidemic in the West, where men who they do fight for their country, they find it difficult to adjust once they leave. So it is, I think, just a hidden curse of just this modern era where we do have to fight to preserve freedom, to help the world. But at the same time, it has such massive effects that once they get back, there's almost nothing we can do to help them. There's drugs, there's therapy, Some men manage to cope, some don't, but we still don't have a solution to this. And this article just really brings out just how wide-ranging these effects can be.
Yeah, the article, if you want to read it, it's at the New York Times Magazine. What if PTSD is more physical than psychological? And it really does bring out some interesting points, as you were bringing to us there, Abraham. And it does talk about a few people in particular, and there's some pictures there of things. And what was kind of very sobering, I guess, is that gentleman I referred to earlier, that soldier who had the names of his fallen comrades written on his back. He has his name on the back as well. I guess assuming that he's going to take that same path,
right,
at some point. So really, really just a horrible situation there. And well, it'd be good when there isn't war. But for now, that is the reality that people do face. So that's an interesting write-up. You can read that again at the New York Times Magazine if you'd like to get a little more information about that. And it is something that's in the news quite a bit, so it's a pretty good read to look at. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, take a look at a few things that have happened on this day in history.